You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, what should we do? By the way, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. So back to my question, what should we do about the Republicans who are plotting treason as we speak? I'm going to explain all that to you in about 10, 15 seconds. Also, in our second hour today, why Texas won't take sex education money and my take on what's really going on about it. And in our third hour, and this is not an exaggeration, this is going to totally blow your mind. We're going to talk about the end of the world as we know it. And I definitely don't feel fine about it. But to get to Republican treason, here's the question of the day. Have Republicans committed treason? Or is it sedition? Or is it just a conspiracy to destroy the lives of millions of working Americans in order to make Obama a one-term president? Here's Mitch McConnell confirming on Meet the Press earlier this year what he had said the day after. I beg your pardon? Oh, it was in Fox News Sunday, excuse me. Confirming what he had said the day after President Obama was sworn into office. The previous day, by the way, there had been this very important meeting that we talked about a little bit last week. I want to get back to today. But here's Mitch McConnell.
One of your quotes from last year where you said, quote, the single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. So how do you respond to those Democratic lines of attack?
Well, that is true. That's my single most important political goal.
Well, that is
every
true.
That's every Republican in the country. But that's true.
That's, you know, we can just cut it right there. It's enough. Treason. And just wait until 2012. Well, here we are. That must have been last year's quote. So anyhow, here we are. Treason is defined by the Merriam-Webster Dictionary as the offense of attempting by overt acts to overthrow the government of the state to which the offender owes allegiance. So I guess for it to be treason, you'd have to say overthrowing the president is overthrowing the state. I'm not sure it reaches that point, but if you're talking about bringing down the state in order to overthrow the leader, maybe it does. Sedition is almost there. It's defined by the same dictionary, Merriam-Webster, as incitement of resistance to or insurrection against lawful authority. Now, here's why I'm asking this question. What is the crime that these guys are guilty of? What should we call it? When Louise and I first moved to Washington, D.C. 2 years ago, there was this very expensive restaurant on the backside of our apartment building, right across the street from the FBI headquarters down at the near the corner of 9th Street and D, Northwest. It's a restaurant. It's called the Caucus Room. And it's owned by a group of really serious political players in this town, including a Democrat by the name of Tom Boggs, who I've never heard of. Must be an old-time guy. Former RNC chairman Haley Barbour and the Carlyle Group's Ed Mathias. It's very expensive, very exclusive, very fancy, very high-end restaurant. And, in fact, it's so much so that Louise and I have never eaten there, even though we walk by it every night when we come home from doing our TV show, because it used to be on the way, and it's right next door to our apartment building. But, you know, you look at the menu and you go, whoa, you know, I'm paying that much for what? Well, it turns out what you're paying that much for is the privacy of being able to conspire collectively and privately against the government or just, you know, hang out with lobbyists or whatever. More than once, as Louise and I walked on our way home from doing, you know, our evening TV show, we saw distinguished senators. In one case, the guy literally was so drunk he couldn't stand up. This was a senator, clearly in his 70s. I don't want to name the guy, but two very attractive young women and fairly muscular, one on each arm, carrying him out to. And when they got to the SUV, one of them said, "Now, Senator, lift your left leg." I mean, just too drunk to walk a straight line. Right out to waiting black SUVs or limousines. In this case, it was a black SUV. you know, coming out of this restaurant. So there was a meeting that was held in the caucus room, this restaurant called the Caucus Room, according to a new book by Robert Draper. And that meeting was not about getting drunk, unless you mean drunk with power. It was a small group of 14 Republicans. Here's the list. Frank Luntz, Newt Gingrich, and then the following elected representatives. Congressmen, and they're all men. Congressman Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, and Dan Lundgren. And Senators Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. 14 Republicans sat together and planned how to destroy the Obama presidency literally the evening that it began. This was January 20th, the day that President Obama was sworn into office. Draper writes about it in his new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. He writes, and I'm quoting now from the book, the dinner lasted nearly 4 hours. They parted company almost giddily. The Republicans had agreed on a way forward, show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies, begin attacking vulnerable Democrats on the airwaves, win the spear point of the House of Representatives in 2010, which they did, by the way, jab Obama relentlessly in 2011, win the White House and the Senate in 2012. End of quote from the book. Newt Gingrich was there. Some of the most prominent Republican members of Congress, as I mentioned, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, John Kyle, Jim DeMint, perhaps most importantly, Tom Coburn. And Frank Luntz was there. He's not only a Republican pollster, he's also a Fox News employee. They all sat around a square table, and you can actually see the table over at the caucus room's website, and plotted the end of the Obama presidency. And this meeting, this secret meeting, this plot was hatched on January 20th, 2009, the day Obama was sworn into office. Robert Draper in his book notes that Representative Paul Ryan warned that everyone, quote, had to stick together. End quote. Representative Kevin McCarthy chimed in saying, quote, we got to challenge them on every single bill and challenge them on every single campaign, end quote. Because Frank Luntz was there, that pretty much meant that Fox News, Fox so-called News, was almost certainly on board this treason or sedition or whatever you want to call it. And Fox News' coverage since then seems to back that up. As Newt Gingrich said after dinner, quote, you will remember this day. You'll remember this is the day the seeds of 2012 were drawn or were sown, excuse me, end of quote. These guys drew up a national suicide pact, and the plan was, in my words, not theirs, destroy the republic and the middle class and blame it all on Obama. Because of 30 years of Reaganomics and George W. Bush's disastrous presidency, two unpaid wars, unpaid-for Medicare drug benefit, deregulation of the banksters, crashing the world's economy, our nation was already in a free fall. When these 14 men met, our economy was hemorrhaging 700,000 jobs a month. People were losing their homes from coast to coast. College graduates couldn't find work. Wages were collapsing. People couldn't make their mortgage payments. Millions were losing their health insurance because of the Bush crash. And these Republicans wanted to keep it that way for four more years and thus shift all the blame for all that pain away from Reaganomics and Bushonomics and onto Obama. And to do that, they had to make sure that anything Obama tried to do to solve the problem failed to get through the House or the Senate. Congressman Pete Sessions, after the meeting, told the National Journal that they were launching, quote, a Taliban insurgency, end quote, against Obama. And that's just what they did. Over 200 pieces of economic recovery legislation, from laws that would end outsourcing to laws that would make the rich pay their fair share of taxes, all shot down by Republican filibusters in the Senate. This is incredible. I got to tell you about Tom Colburn's role in this right after this. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And how is the world going to end as we know it? And I mean that literally, and I mean in the next century or so. We'll talk about it in our third hour today. Yeah, well, it is a manic Monday, but I'm kind of glad, you know, I like Mondays. I do. I love my work. What can I say? And I, as depressing as the news may be, and I'll tell you when we get to our third hour, it's not, it's not so much depressing because there are possibilities, ways that we can make it through. But in the third hour today, we're going to be talking about what Republicans and corporations are doing that literally could end the world in the lifetime of people who are alive right now, and what we can do to stop them. But anyhow, back to this topic that I was talking about. Even, you know, as I said, over 200 pieces of legislation were passed out of the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi was running the House of Representatives first 2 years of the Obama administration, and, you know, went to the Senate. Laws that, for example, would stop tax breaks for companies that outsource jobs and give tax breaks to companies that bring jobs back to America. Laws that would make corporations like ExxonMobil actually pay some income tax on the hundreds of millions of on the billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits that they make. So even though the Democrats theoretically controlled the Senate, Senate rules allow a single senator to put what's called a secret hold on a bill, effectively killing it. It won't even make its way to committee, much less to the floor. Senator Tom Coburn alone, one of the guys who was at that meeting at the caucus room restaurant on the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated, Tom Coburn alone did this over and over. And they call him Dr. No. He's an MD. They call him Dr. No. Because he put so many of these bills on hold, bills that would have funded the FAA, that would have funded highway repairs, that funded veterans benefits, that funded food safety, that funded health care for 9/11 responders. See, he didn't give a damn how popular it would have been. His goal was to deny Obama a second term. Funding for a new Smithsonian Institution, a museum about women's history. Funding for a 9/11 memorial. Funding for bike paths in cities. Funding for wildlife protection. It just, the list goes on and on and on. Tom Coburn stopped. You know, Republicans constantly come on this program or call into this program and go, "Oh, you guys had your chance. You know, Obama could, Democrats controlled the House and Senate for 2 years." It's a lie. Senate rules allow Tom Coburn, one guy, one of the men from that meeting, to stop bill after bill after bill. And of course, he wasn't alone. And John Kyle did a few of, and you know, the John Anson probably did. We know Jim DeMint did some. I mean, the senators who were in that meeting, the guys who were in a position to absolutely stop everything: Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Anson, and Bob Corker. The men from that meeting at the caucus room restaurant controlled the legislative outcome, even sabotaging the stimulus and Obamacare. So that instead of the stimulus and Obamacare being strong progressive programs like the president originally proposed, they became giveaways to big banks and health insurance companies. These Republicans were so successful that federal spending increases under Obama are lower than any president since Herbert Hoover. This was not the president's idea. This was an austerity program forced on America by the men who were in that room, in that meeting, to crash our economy. So again, the question, what do you call it when a small group of Republicans gather to intentionally sabotage an entire nation just so their party can win political power off the pain of working Americans? Is it treason? Is it sedition? Or is it simply the most corrupt, evil, and petty sort of politics that Washington, D.C. has seen since Newt Gingrich shut down the government and threw millions of Americans out of work because Bill Clinton had made him fly in the back of Air Force One? And also, what does it say about our press that none of the major networks, have reported on this story? None of them. That basically nobody's talking about this. It's like a giant secret. You know, Fox is going fast and furious 24/7. Daryl Issa is gonna go after Eric Holder on this these phony trumped up charges that he's not complying with the subpoenas from when he's turned over tens of thousands of pages to Daryl Issa. It's like bread and circus. Just distract the people with trivia while they are blocking a highway bill. I mean, as we speak, the annual legislation for the, you know, the renewal of the highway bill, or maybe it's biennial, but whatever it is, the renewal of the highway bill, which simply provides federal matching funds to the states so that they can fill potholes and resurface their roads. It runs out in 3 weeks. It runs out at the end of this month. And when that runs out, 1.9 million people get laid off, which means the unemployment rate goes from 8.2% to over 9%, which means if the Republicans can keep it there until November, Obama doesn't get reelected. What do you call that? Is it treason? What do you call the networks that are not reporting on this? What do you call the newspapers that won't touch this story? What do you call, you know, what do you call public radio that doesn't talk about this? How would you describe it? Treason is a little too specific. Treason has to do with giving aid and comfort to the enemies of a nation. These guys are becoming the enemies of a nation, but even that's a bit of an overstatement because they're not becoming the enemies of the top 1%. Top 1%, they're doing just fine. But it's not the top 1%'s vote that they need to get Mitt Romney into office and you know, who wants to lay off some more firefighters, teachers, and cops and kick Barack Obama out. And this goes way beyond the partisan politics of Obama and Romney. I mean, this goes all the way to the realm of you know, progressive movements.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So what do you call it? You can post over at TomHartman.com, post a blog or on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us, or you know, all of those things on YouTube. But also we'll take your calls. Tom Hartman here with you. And so what do you call this? What, you know, what would the name be? Is it treason? Is it traitor? Is it, you know, what do you call it? Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what would you call it?
I would call it, at the very least, a political conspiracy.
Okay.
And it has the ramifications that could be far-reaching to the degree of treason. However, in all fairness, you don't ever want to debate some of the merit of some of those bills that they stopped. And I think some of the bills they stopped, I think it's a blessing that they were.
Okay. You're on the record. Megan in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Megan, your thoughts on this?
I'm a 70-year-old grandmother and a Vietnam veteran, and I consider it a traitorous, treasonous act funded by the corporatocracy, which is global.
Okay.
They're going to take us down. Thank
okay.
you.
Great. Thank you, Megan. Singh. Singh in Colorado Springs, Colorado?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
We've had this conversation before, you know. You lay down with dogs, you get up with fleas. No offense to the dogs.
Yeah.
Obama, before he got elected in, he did the bailout. He supported a lot of that.
Excuse me, it was George W. Bush who did two TARPs, who did the bailout, and who decided to keep the banks intact.
This is my turn. This is my turn. Now, what I said was Obama supported it. Okay?
Okay.
And we trusted Obama. We didn't trust Bush. But we trusted Obama, and at least I don't know about the rest of the country, but I said, okay, I'm going to stand back, and if he says that this will work, and he's going to read that bill, because a change was coming, okay?
But do you recall, Singh, that I have to interrupt you, I'm sorry. Do you recall that Obama also proposed legislation that would help underwater homeowners, that Nancy Pelosi got it out of the House of Representatives, and that it died in the United States Senate at the hands of the Republicans?
Yes, I do. And I also see, and I'm also a recipient of one of those. See, one of the things I don't think a lot of people understand about the most recent president's the restructure program,
mm-hmm.
a lot of people cannot read, and it is complicated. Let me tell you something. We have a real surprise in store in the years to come. That bill, the banks have, as you so kindly put it, screwed. There's another word for it. Us again.
Yeah.
All right? But my point is, Obama, when he appointed or reappointed so much of the Wall Street posse, I'm even going to say gang, posse, yeah. when he said Larry Summers, oh, Geithner, Bernanke, oh, God, Tom, please, let me stick my finger down my throat.
Yeah. Singh, I don't totally disagree with you on those points, but that is not to the point of the question that I'm posing, which is these 14 Republicans got together and said, we are going to block every substantive effort by this president to restore this country or to at least allow this economy to recover. And we're going to do it so that we can take the White House in 2012. I consider that a crime. Jeff in San Francisco, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's Bill Maher said it's a coup, and that's pretty much what I think it is. And also, one thing I'd like to bring up is we should be pushing for a high-speed rail in this country. And I think one reason they want to get that down is because it's been our former union there, kind of like the Porter's Union back in the day.
Right.
And they'll have more political power.
Yeah, well, maybe or maybe not. But, but then you got like Rick Scott who said, oh, federal money to build high-speed rail between Tampa and Orlando? Nah, we'll pass. Scott Walker, high-speed rail between Milwaukee and Met? Nah, we'll pass. We don't need no stinking jobs in this country. And by passing on the money, they just basically evaporated. Jeff, excellent point. Coup d'etat. Okay. Ned in Chicago. Hey, Ned, what's up? What do you call it?
You mean Neil in Chicago?
Neil, my apologies. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, I'm sort of calling on a related issue, but you're right. It is, first of all, a betrayal of the American people. It is a betrayal of their trust, and it is probably a violation of their oath of office. That's number one. But what I was particularly interested in is with these leaks of the White House, nobody seems to bring up on television or radio about the Valerie Plame affair where Rove and Cheney and Armstrong were involved in outing a CIA operative, and that was a violation of the law, you know, and here it was blatant. It wasn't even a leak that somebody secretly, well, at right. first it was.
No, we've got the page that Cheney wrote the notes in the margin of, you know, it is so obvious that in the case of Valerie Plame, Dick Cheney committed treason, and that was made into a brilliant movie, by the way. Yes, you're absolutely right. Thank you for reminding me of that. Mike in Newark, New Jersey. Hey, Mike, what do you call it?
Hi, Tom. It is true that this was pretty despicable what this group of Republicans did, but we have to be careful that we don't sound like a bunch of slobbering babies. I mean, it is politics, and that's how the game is played.
No, it's traditionally not how the game is played. In fact, in the 230-plus years that this country has existed, the Republicans in the United States Senate over the last couple of years, for the first time in all those years since George Washington, have required 60 votes for every single piece of legislation. It never happened in the history of the country until Barack Obama became president. Never happened. In the history of the country. Let me say that again for all of those out there who have heard this Republican talking point over and over and over. Oh, it's just politics. They all do it. Body, body, body. It had never happened in the history of the country until Barack Obama became president and these Republican leaders met over at the caucus room on the day he was inaugurated and essentially swore an oath to each other and to Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Henseling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Senators Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker got together and said, my words, not theirs, we are going to destroy, we're going to crush the middle class, we're going to create so much pain, so much heartache, so many broken families, so many suicides, so many people who have lost their health care, so many people who have lost their homes, so many people who are so hurting and trying to figure out who to point to blame for that hurt. And then we are going to point to Obama and say, he's the guy. That's what they decided. BB in Seattle. Hey, BB, what's up? What do you call it?
Tom, it's nothing but treason, plain and simple. How these people continually get away with this, I don't understand. Why is it that...
Let me tell you really simply. I'm talking about this, and CBS, NBC, ABC, NPR...
They don't talk about
it. ...are not.
They don't want to talk about it.
That's how they get away with it.
Because they're owned by GE and all these big, huge companies. Wasn't it you last week that put up the grid that had all the things connected all the way down to the last nth dollar? That's what it comes down to. These people don't care about this country. They want to destroy this country.
Well, they care about this country to the extent that they can loot it. You know, 93% of all income gains in the last decade have gone to the top 1%. You're absolutely right, BB. Thank you very much. Well said. Nate in Annapolis, Maryland. Hey, Nate, what's up? What do you call it?
Hey, Tom, before you have an apoplectic fit, hear me out, okay? I call it heroism, and here's why. Okay, our national debt is $15 trillion, yes?
And who ran that up?
Everybody did.
No, everybody didn't. Three Republican presidents ran that up. Ronald Reagan tripled the national debt, borrowed more money than every president from George Washington and Jimmy Carter combined. And then George Herbert Walker Bush almost doubled Reagan's debt. And then George W. Bush added $5 trillion to the national debt and put into place two wars that were not paid for there on the national credit card and a prescription drug program that was not paid for on the national credit card and brought us a huge economic recession, which was not obviously not paid for, and also gave tax breaks to the very rich and put that on the national credit card, handed that off to Obama. Obama couldn't just in one day say, okay, no more drug program, no more war in Iraq, no more war in Afghanistan, no more recession, and no more Bush tax cuts. Couldn't do that.
Okay.
And you guys, okay. Republicans sit around and blame Obama for this? I beg your pardon?
I'm not blaming anybody, Tom. Here's what I'm simply saying. Our national debt is $15 trillion. Yeah?
So what?
Okay.
The national debt of Japan is twice their GDP. Their economy is doing just fine, thank you very much.
The national debt
of the United States right now is lower than it was when Dwight Eisenhower was president. So what?
It's lower. And how is that possible?
It's lower because we went to 127% of GDP to win World War II.
Okay.
And right now it's less than 90% of GDP.
In a global emergency, I agree. But this is not a global emergency.
It's not a global emergency that the banks have crashed, are literally crashing countries all over the world. I'm sorry, Nate. You are failing to persuade me. This is economic sabotage by an organized criminal organization that calls itself a political party.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What do you call what these Republicans are doing by inflicting pain on average working people so that they can blame it on Obama? How does your diet affect your risk of developing cancer? And what are some of the most effective ways to protect yourself from cancer? And what do you do if you get a cancer diagnosis? Dr. Mitchell Gaynor, founder and president of Gaynor Integrative Oncology, joins me, Tom Hartman, for this week's Conversations with Great Minds. You can see it over at conversationswithgreatminds.com, which is an incredibly cool website. And Robert in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Hey, Robert, what do you call this conspiracy, as Dan so aptly described it, by these Republicans to crash the presidency of President Obama?
Despotic rule, crimes against humanity, human beings that are being mistreated in this country from people that are supposed to represent them in Congress. That's the issue, is that nobody's going after Congress. That should be the full-fledged campaign for the next election in the Senate, in the House.
Yeah.
The presidency is far less important than that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you.
The other thing I don't understand, Tom, is we have the internet today. We have massive communication, a vehicle that could change the world, and nobody is fighting back.
Mm-hmm.
I ask that somebody, and I'm certainly not qualified to do it, to take what I call a national austerity day. You want to tell the Republicans something? Buy nothing for one day. Do no business in the banks, the grocery stores, the gas stations. Send a message to Congress and the corporate world that we do have power.
Yeah, you're talking about a national strike. A
national strike just on business. That we buy nothing for one day.
Yeah, yeah. Good idea. The problem, Robert, is that works in countries where you've got 80, 90, 95% unionization, and there's an infrastructure where everybody can communicate with everybody else. But in this country, we don't so much have that, other than on the right, where they've got Fox News.
Did we not do it with the Bank of America over a simple thing like their fees?
Well, actually, yeah, there was quite an outcry, and they did. Good point. Robert, thank you very much for that. Very excellent point. Linda in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Linda, what's up? What do you call it?
I was just wondering, with this treason thing, you would think they wouldn't want this to get out. How did they find out about it? Was it a spy in there?
Yes.
I mean,
you know, this guy wrote this book, Robert Draper. He has not revealed his sources to the best of my knowledge. We're trying to book him for the show to get the details. But, you know, so far, nobody is sure exactly how he learned of the details of this meeting. So it might have been a waiter.
Oh, God. This is awful.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you very much for the call. David in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I would call it a pure insanity with a little hint of racism and a little dash of conspiracy. It's like a combination of a bunch of different things.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of like want to take this all the way back to that Scott Walker victory a few days ago. I was like just browsing throughout YouTube and seeing comments based on the news feed coming in, and there was one from a Tea Party person saying, yeah, he won, cry, liberals cry. And I made a reply, I never got a response to it, but I told him, I do cry. I cry for you, and I cry for not just my fellow progressives and libertarians, but I also cry for conservatives and the Tea Party, because in the end, no one is immune to this, what they're doing, not just in that state, but nationwide as far as what the story you're talking about today, because no one is immune, and even people that are well off here and there, they're going to get screwed too, because there's only so many cuts and so much disparity that they can cause, and we all have kind of a symbiotic relationship with each other as far as different jobs and different social classes, because if everybody's screwed, then who's going to buy stuff? Who's going to buy the products?
Yep.
And if it happens worldwide, who's going to buy anything? They'll screw themselves in the end, and that's all I have to say.
Yeah, and symbiosis is the way of nature. Well said, David. Thank you. Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will. What do you call it?
Hey, Tom. To me, it's pretty simple. When elected officials knowingly do harm to American citizens, that's treason. It's really not that complicated. I mean, you know, really. I mean, that's what they're doing. It's knowingly doing harm to us.
Right.
That's treason. That's really, to me, this is really not a great area. You know, I would also say it's evil. it's evil. You know what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, one of the members of Congress, one of these guys who was at that meeting, Pete Sessions. He said, Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire process. And these Taliban are an example of how you go about to change a person from their messaging to their operations to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with Democrats. That's what he said to the National Journal in March of 2009.
These people really have. I have to admit. I'd be lying to say they are scaring the hell out of me. I mean, I am afraid of these people. I mean, I don't know how I could.
This is the kind of rhetoric that came out of the hard right in the 1930s in Europe. You know, this is Mussolini style, Franco style. You know, the 60s and 70s in South America, Allende style. This is hard right rhetoric. The ends justify the means, and the means can be violent and nasty, and that's just fine because we end up in power. right? And it is just incredible. Thank you very much for the call. Nancy in Oaklawn, Illinois. Hey, Nancy, what do you call it?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
Just wondering, you know, I love this all this talk about treason and everything, because I think they've been treasonous for a long time, but why is no one speaking of the fact that they took an oath when they were sworn in to uphold the Constitution and then went and signed on with Grover Norquist, and instead they're supporting him? So what, isn't that treasonous?
Well, arguably that is too. I mean, it's just an entire fabric of it, apparently. Thank you. Jeanette in Macon, Georgia. Jeanette, just a half a minute till the end of this hour. What's up? What do you call it?
There. Yeah, I just wonder, what do we do? This is not the first time I've heard about this book.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think a lot of people know about it. And as citizens, what is our power? What do we do? Because they have
we tell everybody we know, and you get and you create movement politics, and you join movement politics. You show up. You occupy something. You join Progressive Democrats of America or Democracy for America or one of the other great progressive groups out there, MoveOn.org, whatever it may be. Join the Occupy movement. Show up. Get involved with a political party if you're inclined. Join the Republican Party and help them take it back from the crazies. Join the Democratic Party and turn it into a more progressive organization. There is so much that can be done. Just voting is not enough. We'll be.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Heather Sermo on the line with us. Texas is engaged in some rather strange, well, from my point of view, rather strange behavior with regard to sex education. Heather, welcome back to the program.
Great to be on, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us. I hope all is well with you and in your world. I should introduce you appropriately. Heather is a blogger, and she's associate with Blueskin Solution. HeatherSermo.com is Heather's blog. And the problem with abstinence-only education. What we're seeing is that the current rate of teen pregnancies is nationwide the lowest on record since the CDC began to keep those stats in 1940. However, in states with abstinence-only education, like Mississippi, instead of being at that record low of 35 per 1,000 girls, it's a 65. It's back where other states were before they started doing comprehensive sex ed. What should we do about states like Texas and Mississippi that don't require sex ed, or when they do, they require it be abstinence-only education?
Well, I am a big proponent of states making decisions about sex education. I don't think that the federal government should be sending money to states to mandate, you know, whether it should be abstinence only or so-called abstinence plus education. I think, you know, the outside critics weighing in on what's going on in Texas is helpful for Texans to, you know, weigh in on in their own local communities on how their own sex education programs should be run. Parents should definitely play a role. And you know what? In preparing for this conversation today, I realized that, you know, there are some communities in Texas, like Harris County, in which Houston is, and Midland, Texas, that are actually considering revising their sex education programs. Parents want them to talk about other things besides just abstinence. And you know what? I think that that's fine. The community value should be reflected in the sex education programs. And I can choose whether to live there or not. And
so,
I can choose whether to opt my child out of that program if I don't believe in it.
Okay. So Texas has the third highest rate of teenage births in the country, the second highest rate of repeat births to teenage girls in the country. They're ahead of Rwanda, Micronesia, and Egypt in terms of teenage pregnancies. This is pretty startling. And your argument is basically a Tenth Amendment argument that the federal government should not be setting standards for or giving money to any state to create to help mitigate what I hope we can agree is a public health problem. Do I have that right?
That is correct. No, I don't think the federal government should be mandating it. I think that the sex education program should be determined by the states and local communities.
So you're okay.
The solution is not to have the federal government step in and tell Texas what to do. And there's another issue here, too, Tom, that should not be overlooked. You know, a sex education program is a short-term thing. It happens, you know, part of the year. Sometimes it's only a week-long program. Our society does not support abstinence only education. And even condoms, you know, when they are presented in the classroom, they're not sexy, you know, and the whole idea of them being part of pop culture, it's just not happening. When was the last time you watched a sitcom or watched a movie like Bridesmaids and saw someone say, oh, wait a minute, let me put on my condom? It totally ruins the mood.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if we really want to see changes happening in our culture that are for the good, we need to see pop culture as well.
We can turn this into a critique of pop culture, Heather, and we probably have similar perspectives. But this is about the demonstrated relationship between states using comprehensive sex education and having lower rates of teenage pregnancies, and states refusing to use comprehensive sex education or even mandating abstinence only and calling that sex education and having exploding rates of teenage births. And my concern is that you and I, through our tax dollars, are supporting these unwed mothers. We're supporting the social ills that come along with children who are essentially unwanted, who grow up feeling unwanted, who grow up more often than not in terrible poverty, and grow up to commit crimes and be a further burden upon society in a way that could have been prevented if their mothers simply understood how human reproduction works.
Yes, that's true. I think that there needs to be...
Doesn't this fall under the general welfare clause?
But I also think, too, Tom, that within the classroom environment, there shouldn't just be an emphasis on, okay, learning about how reproduction happens and how to prevent it and avoid it. But there also should be a deeper discussion about how to protect your heart. You know, and I know this might sound a little cheesy to...
I agree with you.
You know, but, you know, a condom doesn't do that, and we need to emphasize the importance of family. I mean, it's a whole societal problem. And I think Texas is facing this. They have a lot of issues that they haven't had to deal with in the past because they have so many people from all over the world, but mostly Mexico, coming in. And, you know, they're having to readjust a lot of things. And I think we're seeing things happen. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think that they are having to deal with the problem. But it's just not happening as fast as we like. As I mentioned, there are local communities that are reevaluating the way they are implementing sex education. And they're using parents. They're using research from companies and federal government, you know, the federal government, what they put out there to reevaluate their programs.
That's all well and good, Heather, but that's sort of like saying back in the 50s, you know, hey, there's some communities in the United States that allow opposite couples to get married. That proves things are going in the right direction. You know, eventually we'll all get there. There's a couple communities in the United States where African Americans can sit at a lunch counter with whites. It seems to me that if this is impacting the general welfare of the United States, if this is having a substantial impact, that we shouldn't say, oh, gee, you're a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. You were born in an enlightened community in Texas. You get to learn about how human reproduction works. But your cousin who is not a member of that club, who lives in a part of Texas that's run by religious zealots, and I'm reluctant to even say that because that suggests that there's something wrong with religion or zealotry, and I think that there's something to be said for both. But you know, who at least doesn't believe in children and particularly teenagers understanding how human reproduction works, that there's no federal role for this, and yet many of the consequences of the failures of the state of Texas and the state of Mississippi and these other states where they have mandated abstinence-only sex education, which is an oxymoron, but that's what they call it, that the consequence of that is being picked up for, is being paid for by us. Now, you could argue that the federal government shouldn't be paying for the health care of poor people and, you know, unemployment benefits and prisons and rehabilitation and, you know, all the other things that come along with, you know, unwanted pregnancies, unwanted people, throwaway kids, latchkey kids, all the problems associated with poverty that are exacerbated by teenage. You could argue that, but that's not the perfect universe in which we live. The universe in which we live is one where you and I, with our tax dollars, are picking up the tab for these unwanted pregnancies that are accidental, I would say, you know, these blundering pregnancies, because these kids don't understand how human reproduction works. And you know, so anyhow, my end of my rant.
But I still think that having a federal mandate, it's one thing. We've seen it across the board. You know, federal mandates are really difficult to. There's not a one size fits all approach.
Well, no, they worked well in the 60s. You know, you can't discriminate against people based on their color, on their race.
Yeah, but that's not. We're not talking about a race issue right now. We're talking about an issue that is very complicated. Sex education and how it's implemented. You know, I don't think. Yes, I realize that in the article that you're alluding to, the Gail Collins article upon which the discussion is based, she likes to look at those strange curriculum that are out there.
But we're talking really about teaching science, Heather, aren't we? Isn't this just the science of human reproduction? Shouldn't kids get that as part of, you know?
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is they are getting that. The whole idea that the average Texas student doesn't understand how an egg and a sperm come together is ridiculous.
Okay. Heather, we're out of time, but I'll leave you with the last word. HeatherSermo.com. You can check it out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Heather, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
It's always nice talking with you. We'll be back with more right after this.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because we're kind of going from one end to the other. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about how the world is going to end, or one very probable scenario that will lead to the death of millions and millions of human beings, and in all probability, in the lifetimes of people who are alive today. And right now, we're talking about bringing people into the earth, you know, into the world, the lives of people. And what do we do? I think that teaching sex education and calling it, quote, abstinence only. In other words, basically all of sex education becomes, okay, there's this thing called sex, and don't do it. End of class. I think that's sort of like saying, hey, let's talk about math. 1 and 1 is 2, that's addition. 2 minus 1 is 1, that's subtraction. We're not going to talk about geometry. You know, eventually you can learn about calculus, but we're just not going to talk about any other math. This, you know, human reproduction is science. Sex education should be a subset of science class. And Heather's right. There is a dimension to this which should be discussed, the interpersonal dimension. She said how to avoid your heart being broken. You know, it's a beautiful, elegant way to say it. I would go even farther than that, you know, how to avoid getting sexually transmitted diseases and things like that. I mean, there's a scientific dimension to it, but, you know, there's not just the individual tragedy of romance gone wrong or romance interrupted by pregnancy, but there's also the social facility of, you know, being, how do you function in a society, in a micro society, in a high school where there's pressure to be sexually active and you don't want to be? How do you continue to function? These are things that should be talked about in school. They should be discussed with people who actually, you know, adults who've been there, done that, seen how it comes out, and can tell, here's how the movie ends, guys. And we're not, because we've got this religious zealotry, and an earlier caller, you know, said it was Catholic. It's not. I'm telling you, it's the fundamentalist Protestants are at the tip of this spear. Anyhow, Angela in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Angela, what's up?
Obviously, you have to take a really good sex ed class to say that it promotes, to really see that it doesn't, you know, that it promotes promiscuity. I mean, if you take one, it is like birth control, because the really good teachers will tell you all the possible ramifications of sexual activity. And the more you think about it, the more teenagers will think, well, maybe I'll wait.
Yep.
Maybe it's, you know...
And that's
what other things.
And that's what the statistics show, is that kids who have comprehensive sex ed tend to become sexually active later, and less frequently, with fewer sexual partners, fewer side effects, as in sexually transmitted diseases in pregnancy.
I'll go one step farther, Tom. I think if you really want to go into this and help create a better society, I think they need to start parenting classes.
Yes.
If you really want to lower teenage pregnancy, give them a parenting class in high school.
Teach them how to change a diaper.
Teach them how do you handle, you know, a screaming toddler?
Right.
What is the best method?
Right.
And
what do you do when your kid has diarrhea? What do you do when your kid has a fever? What do you do when they can't sleep through the night? I know
many kids who did that, and you know what? They wait the longest because when you learn all the responsibilities involved, there isn't that fantasy that you're going to get married.
Yes.
And, you know, you're going to come home to perfect kids after the end of the workday.
Yeah.
The reality sets in.
Yeah, what
and
do you do if you...
A lot of people need the reality. And, yes, you know, you have to teach, you know, how to not break, you know, to have a broken heart. I would say more girls have broken hearts from false promises from boyfriends, and they were ignorant. They didn't have the proper sex education.
Right, and the promise that was made was just basically to get in their pants, as the old phrase goes. Angela,
yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. Thank you for the call. And what continually baffles me is why we graduate kids from high school who understand math and science and maybe even know who Aristotle is, but they don't know how to balance a checkbook. They don't know how to do a family budget, and they don't know how to change a diaper. They don't, and to extend that, they don't understand the difference between breastfeeding and bottle feeding in terms of its public health or its health consequences. I mean, all these other things. They don't get any of this. That's what baffles me. Genuinely baffles me. Why don't we? Well, it's because of troglodyte thinking, I think. Marie in San Antonio. Hey, Marie.
Hi, Tom. I'm a first-time caller, and I've been watching your show for a few years now, and I thank you so much for being so brave and speaking out for those of us who are silent.
Thank you.
I was a public health nurse for 20 years, and I recently retired. And I worked in a county here in Texas, and we went round and round about abstinence and abstinence plus education.
Right.
And it's just really sad, like, when we went into discussion groups, I mean, we had some parents that were very fanatical. And I had one man, I remember, tell me that he didn't even want his girl to ever look at her body because it was just nasty, and that shouldn't be right.
Mm-hmm.
And we had other parents that had all these other ideas, and you know, it was just scary. And I also worked in family planning clinics, and it was sad because you have these 35, 40-year-old women who have already had a baby and don't really understand their reproductive system at all because they've never been really given a good education.
Yep.
And so they have all these medical problems that are related, you know, to reproductive, and they have no clue. And I think that's just really not acceptable.
Very, very well
said. And the other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, young women, and this ties into this other thing that's going on, but, you know, they do use contraception.
Yeah, well, learning how to take the birth control pill is one thing, and probably doesn't need to be taught in school because kids will talk about that, but that doesn't mean that they understand anything about how their reproductive system works. Excellent point, Marie. Thank you very much. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And in our next hour, the end of the world as we know it. And no, I'm not kidding. Okay. Yesterday we got this very interesting, well, I don't know if it was yesterday, over the weekend, whatever. Somebody called into our listener rant line, which you can find over at TomHartman.com, and left a An interesting message. Here it is.
I was listening to a rebroadcast of your show, and you did a teaser that said, I'm going to play a clip from George W. Bush that's going to blow your mind. And the next thing I knew, it was Ring of Fire with Mike Papantonio. So I am furiously trying to find out what that clip said. If you would replay it in the third hour on Monday, I might be able to hear it, because that's the only hour I'm able to listen to. Let me know what was the content of that clip. Thanks, Tom.
Okay, thank you very much. Actually, it's not our third hour. Maybe we'll come back. No, I'm gonna play it. We will mention it. You know, just I had forgotten that at the very end she said that third hour. You know, anyway, here's the clip. This was what, and you were listening to a best of show over the weekend, which is why what your local station went to Ring of Fire, which is a great program, and Mike Papantonio is spectacular. Anyhow, here is the clip, and the context of this is these Republicans have this conspiracy. And keep in mind, Tom Coburn is one of the guys who was at this meeting at the caucus room where they plotted the takedown of the American middle class in order to harm President Obama's chances to win re-election in November. Tom Coburn was one of those guys. And today in Victoria Jones's news summary that she sends out to all her radio stations, Secret Fiscal Cliff Talks, I wonder if Victoria even knows that Tom Coburn was part of this meeting. She says, they're worried, really worried, that doing nothing ahead of the year-end fiscal cliff could lead to a voter backlash and an economic catastrophe. So they're trying to cut a deal. About a dozen senators are organizing behind closed doors, from Tom Coburn to Chris Coons to Lamar Alexander to Dick Durbin. They're working on something. But if Tom Coburn is there, well, anyhow, keep in mind, when George W. Bush became president, before he declared war on Afghanistan, after they offered to arrest bin Laden and give him to us, and George W. Bush said no, before he declared war on Afghanistan and said, we're not going to put this on the federal budget, we're going to put it on the national credit card. Before he declared war on Iraq and said, we're not going to put this on the budget, we're going to put it on the national credit card. Keep in mind, Obama put all these things on the budget, and the Republicans are bashing him for it. But Obama said, if we're paying for it, we should at least put it on the books. Before George W. Bush pushed through a Medicare drug bill that required that the federal government could not negotiate drug prices, another $300 billion gift to Big Pharma paid for by you and me. Before Obama pushed through a tax cut, a 3% tax cut, and more than that for people like Mitt Romney, who make their living with, quote, capital gains, end quote. Before Bush pushed through a tax cut that, again, he put on the national credit card. Before he did any of these things on the national credit card, in his first State of the Union address, in March of 2001, this was, 6 months before 9/11, but nonetheless, 9/11 didn't have to precipitate $2 trillion worth of wars, right? This was, what George W. Bush said was to Congress in his State of the Union address, you have asked for deficit reduction, and I have listened. And what he's talking about is that Clinton had put us on a trajectory to pay off the national debt in less than 10 years. And here's George W. Bush trying to say, basically, that he's going to stay with Clinton's policies and make this country fiscally whole. Here he is.
Many of you have talked about the need to pay down our national debt. I listened, and I agree. We owe it to our children and grandchildren to act now. And I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years. At the end of those 10 years, we'll have paid down all the debt that is available to retire. That is more debt repaid more quickly than has ever been repaid by any nation at any time in history.
There you go. And George W. Bush talking about how if we just stay with the Clinton policies, everything's going to be wonderful. So there's that. There's sex ed. There's a lot going on in the news. The Supreme Court may be coming back with a decision on Obamacare any day now, a variety of scenarios there. But in any case, Matt, back to your calls. Matt in St. Louis. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, two very important points on abstinence-only education.
Yes, sir.
Recently I read a report about gonorrhea has become antibiotic resistant.
Yes, it is now back where it was in the 19th century. It will kill you.
And secondly, I find it incredibly ironic that America is number one in the world in the production and consumption of pornography, yet we're really not allowed to teach it in science class how reproduction works. Don't you find that incredibly ironic?
I think there's actually a cause-effect relationship there. We're one of the most repressed societies, us in the U.K., at least Western societies. Obviously, there are big problems in the Middle East as well and other places, but we're one of the most repressed societies, and as a consequence of that, we not only have a higher usage of pornography, we also have higher levels of sex crimes of all varieties than most other Western and developed societies do. So, yeah, I find it not only ironic, but I think that there's actually a causal relationship. Thanks for pointing that out, Matt. It needed to be said. Andrew in New York City. Hey, Andrew. Andrew?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I just had a question about the sex ed. You were talking about how, you know, really it should be taught as science, just at its most basic.
I wouldn't say it should. What I was arguing is that it could. I do acknowledge, though, that sex is multidimensional. It has to do with relationships. It has to do with family. It has to do with child rearing.
I understand. My point is, though, that if we could somehow get it into the science curriculum, you would be able to accomplish a lot of the things that you wanted to accomplish, which is just simply teach people how human reproduction works.
Andrew,
and you wouldn't have to deal with that. Yeah.
Texas just took global warming out of their science curriculum.
Okay. Well, it will be at a federal level. That's what you're trying to argue, right?
And the conservatives are trying to use this old canard of, well, it's not in the Constitution. I mean, they've obviously never read the General Welfare Clause or the preamble. But
you could get support for it at the local level, at your local science classrooms, and eventually that would build the movement towards a more federal type of rule.
Yeah. It could. And as I said to Heather, I think that this is a federal issue. Don't make a federal case. I think it is a federal case. Andrew, thank you for the call. Logically, it should be part of science, or it could be part of science. Actually, the core stuff of, it's the difference between meiosis and mitosis. That's when you start teaching it, right? Sexual or cellular division versus asexual cellular division, if I'm remembering my high school biology right, which I might not be. Who knows? I do remember sex ed. Back when I took sex ed, it was, if you masturbate, you'll go blind. I'm not making this up. My sex ed teacher actually told us that. Mac in Victor, Colorado. Hey, Mac, what's up?
Oh, man, I'm glad to talk to you again. I'm talking about sexual relations like in the 60s, because I'm of that age where they didn't even teach us about sex.
Right.
It was like you had to explore it on your own. I think if people would teach their own children about sex before you even entered high school, then we wouldn't have all this teenage pregnancies and unwanted kids, and there wouldn't be any issues about it.
Mac, here's the problem with that. Any sentence that begins with, if only everybody would, is not ever going to be. I mean, if only everybody would understand that I am my brother's keeper, then the world would be a different place. If only everybody, if only every parent taught their kids about sex ed, the reality is that a lot of, really well-intentioned parents are unwilling or unable or incompetent or so wounded about their own sexuality they can't talk about sex ed to their kids. And there's a lot of parents who don't even talk about basic stuff like how to balance a checkbook with their kids or how to clean up their bedroom and do chores. I mean,
I know that sounds kind of socialist, but
well, it's not that. It sounds idealist. And that's my point is that, I agree with you. Parents should be a primary source of sex education and relationship education. But the tragic fact of the matter is that there are a lot of parents who are just as incompetent as educated kids and some who are even worse. Mackie, thank you for the call. I think it's, well said. We just have a minute left here. I want to get one more call in. My apologies, Mac, for cutting you off. Dusty in Detroit. Hey, Dusty, that minute's yours. What's up?
Hey, I used to work in Harris County. I live in Detroit now. I'm retired midwife RN. I used to work in Harris County, which is where Houston is, and I did some sex education there in the schools through our maternity center. The kids had to get written permission from their parents in order to listen to my lecture and watch my films. It ended with a film of a live birth.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the kids who were not sexually active came up later and said, I'm not going to do anything until I get married.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't pushing the abstinence only, but it kind of had that effect. And the ones who were sexually active said, I need to do something that's really going to work. I've just been hoping.
I've just been hoping.
You know,
that's not.
I only use condoms on Thursday night. So,
right.
You know, whatever.
Right. Yeah, well, good on you, Dusty. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like watching a baby being born, and I've watched three of them be born. I caught two of, actually, I caught all three of them. I caught two of the three. And it makes it real for you. It really does. Thank you,
You're
Dusty.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, I think every high school kid in America should watch a baby being born. It's just, it's like, hey, here's the consequence, and it can be a wonderful thing, too. How does your diet affect your risk of developing cancer? And what are some of the most effective ways to protect yourself from cancer? And what do you do if you get a cancer diagnosis? Dr. Mitchell Gaynor, founder and president of Gaynor Integrative Oncology, joins me, Tom Hartman, for this week's Conversations with Great Minds. You can see it over at conversationswithgreatminds.com. And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You could learn more online at germany.info. Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria, what's going on in the world?
Hey, Tom. Well, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, chaired by California Republican Daryl Issa, planning to vote next week on holding Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress.
Now, this is about Fast and Furious, something that is only being reported on by the Fox News Network. No one else is even taking this seriously. Does Daryl Issa know that, or does he just watch Fox News too?
I don't know what news outlet he watches. My guess is that as many of the House Republicans do have Fox News on in their offices, it may be that he has Fox News on as well. I have to say that this was reported by more outlets than Fox today.
Yeah, the fact that he's gonna possibly hold the AG
right.
in contempt, of course.
Right.
Of course.
Right. He said the Obama administration has not asserted executive privilege or any other valid privilege over these materials. These are materials that they want, and it's unacceptable that the DOJ refuses to produce them.
Haven't they already turned them over?
Well, they've turned over 7,600 documents, and Holder has testified eight times. Now, Fast and Furious was a botched operation that provided guns to Mexican cartels.
Which was started during the Bush administration.
Right, with a different name.
Right.
And this one resulted in the death of several U.S. agents.
Right.
Now, the DOJ has responded with a furious statement saying that the move by ISA was unwarranted, saying as recently as a few days ago, the department staff and committee staff were discussing a way toward a resolution of this matter, saying the AG and the DOJ will remain focused on the critical job of protecting this nation and the American people while Chairman Issa continues to play these political games at the expense of all Americans, and went further than that, also saying that Issa has twisted and ignored the facts in his 15-month investigation, and they accused him of operating with a tired political playbook while not addressing the Democrats' proposals to tighten gun trafficking laws in the wake of the failed federal gun tracking operation.
Yeah, but all that stuff, it becomes background noise. The only thing that gets through is ISA is going to hold the AG in contempt, and the fact that it's nonsense and that this is, well, anyway, this is just political. I mean, Daryl Issa is playing Joe McCarthy.
It is entirely political. But I think that it's happening because it's an election year and nothing is going to happen. And Eric Holder can wait out the clock on this one.
Yeah. Okay. So what else is going on?
Even if he is found in contempt. Well, there's another one that's probably going to send you into the stratosphere. Senator John McCain will likely introduce his Senate resolution tomorrow the calls for a special counsel to investigate a recent series of national security leaks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these national security leaks have got many people in Congress quite ticked off. There have been a number of them, about five different leaks to various media outlets, mostly print outlets. And there's been a bipartisan uproar about them in the House and particularly in the Senate of senior lawmakers, with John McCain leading the call and him going so far as to say not only are the leaks coming from the White House, but basically saying that that Obama may have done it, and that, or he may not have done it, but basically that means he may have done it, and that that he's responsible. Obama very sternly said that was not the case last week. Now, the White House has rejected calls for a special counsel, and Eric Holder Friday appointed two U.S. attorneys to investigate, but John McCain doesn't think that's sufficient because he's questioning whether they can be independent.
Well, it is the 40th. It is next week, the 40th anniversary of Watergate. The Republicans would just love to have something like that.
Indeed.
So they're looking under every rock they can. Daryl Issa under one rock, John McCain under another rock. We'll see. I don't think they're going to find anything.
Yes. The whole question of hiring and firing cops, teachers, firefighters, librarians, and what Mitt Romney said about that last week, about them being government workers, do we want more government workers? The answer basically being no. Many people have felt that he would walk back that statement somehow. Well, John Sununu, who's a top campaign surrogate for Romney, went on TV today and doubled down on it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Said, no, in fact, that was correct. He not only said that there are fewer kids in the classroom, that the population's going down and you need fewer teachers. He said there are places where just pumping money in to add to the public payroll is not what the taxpayers in the country want. He said people ought to stop jumping on it as a gaffe and understand that there's wisdom in the comment.
Wow. Well, really, what Romney was calling for was privatizing our schools. And, I mean, there have been experiments in privatizing fire departments. They've been disastrous, but there's some communities that have done it. And increasingly, at least one of the functions of our police departments, that is running prisons, has been massively outsourced and privatized. The consequence of that is that over the last decade and a half or so, the average sentence that somebody serves has doubled. So maybe that's what Romney had in mind. Let's just privatize all this stuff. Give it to his buddies at Correction Corporation of America. It used to be part of Marriott Corporation, you know, a good Mormon company, and off they go.
That's an extraordinary thought.
If I can make you mutter, I know I've... What else is going on, Victoria?
Commerce Secretary John Bryson under investigation for allegedly causing two traffic collisions over the weekend. Commerce Secretary says he had a seizure. The latest update on that is that the Commerce Department is saying that he has limited recall of the event.
Oh, my. So he might have had a seizure or even a stroke or something. Heaven only knows.
He had a seizure or stroke. We don't know at what point during the event.
Thank you, Victoria Jones, brought to you by Germany.info.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
See you in. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I promised you the end of the world as we know it. I'm going to deliver. And while Paul is resetting our phone lines, phytoplankton. You ever heard of phytoplankton? Phytoplankton, phyto means works on sunlight. Plankton, little tiny things, you know, they float around in the ocean, that kind of thing. And what phytoplankton is basically giant clouds of little tiny plants that fill the oceans. It's at the bottom of the food chain, meaning that if it collapses, so too does all other marine life. And if all the marine life collapses, then most land life collapses. And there's a reason why that, for that, and that is that about half of all the oxygen in our atmosphere comes from phytoplankton in our oceans. So, kill off the phytoplankton, and the world as we know it ends. The bad news, we're killing off the phytoplankton. Yikes. FYI to everybody here, I just got a notice that my link to the Telos server is down. I'm trying to bring it back up, but I think it's going to lock up. Back in 2007, a study was done on the reproduction rate of phytoplankton in the Gulf of Maine. And scientists were totally freaked out to discover that the reproduction rate had decreased by a factor of 5, as in 500%. As in the amount of phytoplankton that can be produced in a day now takes 5 days to produce. Now keep in mind, every fish, everything, pretty much, lives on phytoplankton or lives on something that lives on phytoplankton. And now a new study out of the Bigelow Laboratory of Ocean Sciences finds that phytoplankton reproduction, which has been crashing in Maine, that was where they found that 500% drop, it hasn't bounced back. Now, you know, overtly and explicitly, that's bad news for Maine's marine industries, because the food chain that leads to every fish we eat starts with phytoplankton. No phytoplankton, no fish. But even more frightening, this phenomenon isn't exclusive to the Gulf of Maine. It's happening all over the planet. As the science journal Nature published back in 2010, at that point in time, and it's been picking up, and it's starting to pick up exponentially rather than linearly. The world was in 2010 losing 1% of its phytoplankton every single year. And in the northern hemisphere, places like Maine, since 1950, we've seen a 40% drop off in phytoplankton. So we're not just talking about Maine fisheries getting wiped out. We're talking about fisheries around the planet. We're talking about a catastrophic shakeup of the global food chain. And it's not just about food. I mean, we all like to eat, but we all like to breathe even more. Person can go a few days without eating. He can only go a few minutes without breathing. And we can thank phytoplankton for giving us oxygen to breathe. As I said, roughly half the world's oxygen supply comes from phytoplankton, which inhales carbon dioxide and exhales oxygen, and in the process locks up that carbon. But phytoplankton are being killed off by a 1-2-3 punch of warmer waters, changing salinity levels, and most importantly, increasing levels of carbonic acid in the ocean, an acid formed when the ocean absorbs the carbon dioxide that we pump into the atmosphere when we burn coal, oil, gasoline, and natural gas. The global warming from our burning these fossil fuels, it is melting the permafrost and the ice around the Arctic Circle. Now, what is this doing? It's exposing ancient peat bogs, vegetation that in some cases hundreds of thousands, in some cases hundreds of millions of years ago, have been trapped under that ice. Now, you'll recall James Hansen said, you know, if this global warming continues, the world is going to, you know, it'll establish a new equilibrium, but it's not the one to which human life is adapted. So anyhow, this peat, this million-year-old vegetable matter, vegetation, all blackened and browned and, you know, whatever, starts decomposing when it gets thawed out. And that decomposition releases methane, which is a greenhouse gas that is 25 times, as in 2,500%, more potent at warming our atmosphere than carbon dioxide. A team of ecologists with the University of Alaska Fairbanks has found so far, I mean, this is pretty scary, these methane leaks bubbling up. Guess how many they've found so far? All around the north. Northern Siberia, northern Alaska, northern China. 150,000 major methane leaks bubbling methane up into the Arctic, into the waters around the Arctic. As the ice cap gets smaller and smaller and the water gets larger and larger, You know, the governments are all sitting around going, oh, boy, we can drill in the Arctic, or, oh, boy, we can have maritime navigation across the Arctic. Meanwhile, all this permafrost is melting, and all this methane is going into the atmosphere. So to recap, humans are releasing carbon into the atmosphere, which is causing temperatures to rise, which is melting the polar ice caps, which is releasing methane, which is causing temperatures to rise even faster and making the oceans even more acidic, which is contributing to the death of phytoplankton, the very phytoplankton on which the global food chain depends for survival, and we humans depend on for air. If this continues, we're looking at the end of the world as we know it, possibly in this century. And the Republicans in power and the oil barons that they're slaves to, they're determined to let the phytoplankton die off. These lawmakers include people like Virginia State Delegate Chris Stoll, who stripped out the term sea level rise from a state study on climate change because he said it's a liberal code word. The oil, coal, and natural gas barons are now hiring the same phony scientists and using the same tactics that the tobacco companies used in the 1990s to raise doubt about clear scientific evidence that their products are actually killing people, only in this case, killing the earth. $300 million in 2010 in that election came in from outside corporate money, a lot of which came from climate change denying oil, coal, and natural gas corporations. What's the result of that? Every single freshman House of Representatives Republican has gone on record to deny the existence of man-made global climate change. Talk about fiddling while Rome burns. Meanwhile, phytoplankton continues to die off because global temperatures continue to rise. If we haven't already hit a tipping point, and James Hansen is suggesting maybe we have, when it comes to climate change, you know, he was saying we have to worry about 300 parts per million. We're about 350 parts per million. We started, you'll recall, I mean, back during the Nixon administration, we were in the high 200s, 280, 290 parts per million of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. We are now above 400 parts per million. And just like nobody in our press is talking about, you know, this secret meeting that was over at the caucus room restaurant where the Republicans plotted to bring down the Obama administration, nobody in the corporate press is talking about what I just shared with you, which, by the way, is common knowledge in Europe, where they're actually trying to do something about this. There are countries around the world that get it. The Kyoto Accord came out of Kyoto, Japan. The Japanese get it. Only in the United States, where our Supreme Court has said that coal and oil and natural gas barons can corrupt both politicians and the corporate media with their money, only in the United States is this even considered a debate.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what are we going to do to prevent the end of the world as we know it? We'll be back. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. I don't see this. In fact, it's interesting. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine about this over the weekend. I don't see this as an absolute unmitigated disaster that we should all, you know, be putting on sackcloth and pouring ashes over our heads, or wailing and gnashing our teeth, or rending our garments, you know, to get all biblical about it. Although it may be biblical in proportion. I mean, who remembers the people who built the pyramids? They're gone. Who remembers the people who built Ur and Uruk? The Epic of Gilgamesh is sort of still around, but the Sumerians aren't. Who remembers Quetzalcoatl, or however you say it? I've been down there in the ruins near Cancun, and the ruins in Central America. I've, you know, down in Peru, I mean, I did a whole chapter in my book Threshold about the ruins down in Peru, where you know these people were there. They appears to be the mother city, the oldest city in human history, 5,000-6,000 years old, covered with sand. Now, where'd the people go? Kind of into the jungle. What about the Incan Empire? It could be that we're looking at the end of empire. What happened to the Neanderthals? I don't think it's going to be that bad, even if it gets really bad, because I have this enduring faith in the adaptability of humans, because we have these things called big brains and functional minds. But our big brains and functional minds have brought us to this point. And perhaps it's going to take a disaster for us to reorder our society and go back, you know, frankly, and go back to viewing ecology and viewing sustainability as desirable things. Let me give you a context. When Asians first arrived in North America, and there's been a big debate about exactly where and when, it looks like some came over the land bridge from Siberia 10, 12,000 years ago. Others actually apparently came here by boat maybe as much as 20,000 years ago into South and Central America. But in any case, you know, for 20,000 years, North and South America were populated by human beings. And when they arrived here, we had giant three-toed tree sloths that weighed 250, 300 pounds and just hung there, meat on the hook. You could walk up to them, whack them with a stick, and they'd go... I mean, you know, they were slothful, right? We had elephants. They were covered with hair, and they had long tusks. They were called woolly mammoths. We had tigers with giant teeth that you know, were a foot long. I mean, we had a lot of really, really amazing fauna in North America when Europeans first arrived here. And there were a whole bunch of different kinds of big birds. And you look at the history of New Zealand, you know, the Maori, Maori stands for moa eaters. When they first arrived in the island of New Zealand, there were millions of these birds that weighed anywhere from 30 to 250 pounds. And it took them about 400 years to eat them all. And then they were like, where'd the moa go? They ate the last one. Seriously. Same thing happened in the Easter Islands. What are you left with? A bunch of statues. You know, I would say arguably, fortunately for the people in New Zealand, the Maori, you know, Captain Cook came along and there was, you know, contact with other people. Although many of them would say it wasn't so fortunate. And I understand that perspective, too. But the point is that in North America, where I was going with this in North America, and if you find this stuff fascinating, I highly recommend Peter Farb. He's been dead for a decade or more, and so his book is out of print, but you can easily find copies of it. And I base several chapters in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight on Peter Farb's book. Peter Farb, the Rise, Man's Rise to Civilization is the title. And it's an ethnography of Native Americans. And basically what he suggests is they arrived here. There were all these very large animals that were very easy to kill and eat. They killed many of them to extinction and ate them, and then they started realizing they were facing famine. And out of that came a culture that pervaded virtually all the Native American cultures all the way across North America that was, we are looking out for the seventh generation. We are living in a sustainable way. We make decisions based on how they're going to impact the future, not just what we can get now. And when the Europeans arrived, they look at it and said, look at all this meat going to waste. Look at all this land going to waste. Look at all these people. They don't know all the riches they've got. No, they knew all the riches they had. And they were keeping them in trust for future generations because they had seen the disasters. They had seen the famines. They had seen the wars. And the anthropological evidence is there, and it's clear. And they figured out a variety of cultural ways down in the area of where what we now call New Orleans, There was actually a community, a Native American community, that had a caste system. Only in the caste system, the highest caste were the sun gods, the lowest caste were called literally the stinkards. But every generation, your children had to marry into the most distant caste. So if you were the sun god caste, your kids had to be stinkards, or they had to marry into the stinkards. So every family had all castes in it. In other words, everybody was all interconnected. It's like saying the Koch brothers' kids have to marry somebody who's been on welfare for three generations. And what happened was eventually everybody got it that we're all in this together. I mean, maybe it's going to take a disaster to produce that. Or maybe just the threat of one will be enough. But I actually see this, you know, they say, oh, you know, we need a comet to, you know, be heading toward Earth to bring us all together. Here's the comet. It's here right now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, America was all unified, you know, well, the whole world was unified in large part against Hitler. Here's Hitler. It's called Global Warming. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very horrifically ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, Elizabeth Warren. Speaking at the Netroots National Convention in Providence, Rhode Island over the weekend, Warren attacked Mitt Romney and the Supreme Court's notion that corporations are people. She said to the crowd, "No, Mitt. Corporations are not people. People have hearts. They have kids. They get jobs. They get sick. They love. They cry. They dance. They live. They die. Learn the difference." Ms. Warren is absolutely right. Corporations are not people, and the actions they've taken over the last several years show many of them don't have a heart. In fact, none of them have a heart. It's time America woke up and listened to Ms. Warren, because the only way we can begin to rebuild America and retake control of our democracy is to do so. The bad. House Judiciary Committee Chair Lamar Smith. Earlier this year, New Jersey Democratic Representative Steve Rothman introduced a bill that would prevent attorneys from removing jurors from a jury pool just because they're gay, which is a right that gay jurors should already have thanks to the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment. The gay jurors are still discriminated against, which is why Rothman introduced the bill. However, Republican Representative Lamar Smith said he has no plans to move the bill at this time, or in layman's terms, he's blocking it. Thanks to Republicans, the fight over equal rights for gays in America is one step forward, two steps back. And the very, very ugly John Sununu. Last week, Mitt Romney claimed that America needs fewer teachers, firefighters, and police officers. Well, rather than try to explain away the obvious gaffe, Romney campaign chairman John Sununu went on MSNBC this morning and said there was wisdom in the comment. The only wisdom in this comment is the wisdom behind why Americans shouldn't vote for Mitt Romney in November. If they do, they'll be electing a man who wants an America filled with poorly educated children in unsafe neighborhoods, and that is very, very ugly. It's mind-bogglingly ugly. I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's incredibly ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Virginia in Portland. Hey, Virginia, welcome to the program.
Tom, I'm calling to pile on. You're too cheerful about the end of the world as we know it.
Okay.
You've read The Revenge of Gaia.
I can't say I've read it from cover to cover, but I'm familiar with the book.
He says when this all collapses.
Remind me, who's the author?
It's John Lovelock. Yeah, Lovelock.
Yeah, Lovelock. Yeah, he wrote the original Gaia book too. His original Gaia book I thought was really great. Revenge of Gaia is so. He's basically saying, okay, that's it. We're all going to die. Let's just
Game
give
over.
Up. I know.
He says once the collapse occurs, there will probably be regions on the north of the planet that will sustain approximately a quarter of a million people.
Yeah. And A, it's possible. But B, one of the things that I've observed in the many, many decades of my life is that when people, particularly well-educated prognosticators like James Lovelock, get into their 70s and 80s, I think they start mixing up their own personal mortality with that of the human race.
Well, that's possible, but it was in his book that I learned that methane is so much more toxic than carbon as a greenhouse
carbon
gas.
Dioxide,
it has a shorter lifespan, but it's 25 times more damaging than an equal amount of carbon. Robert F. Kennedy was out here about a month ago, and he said there is no body of water in the United States that is not so mercury contaminated you should not eat the fish.
Right.
And Fukushima is still bubbling away. The Japanese don't know what to do with it. And already, you know, the toxic consequences have spread over half the planet, and who knows what it's doing to the ocean. I mean,
we do know, because now we're pulling out of the West Coast. We're pulling cesium contaminated tuna. That's right.
Yeah.
Now, here's the good news.
Yeah.
Iowa and Texas are getting 20% of the electricity from wind now, and Germany last month hit 50% of all the electricity in that country, which is formidable. I mean, they got a huge electric train system and everything else. 50% of the electricity is generated by solar.
I'm not saying we shouldn't do the correct thing, but I think it's probably too late, you know.
I think it's too late for us to continue going the way we're going.
Yeah, we definitely can't keep doing what we're doing, and we ought to be teaching children, among other skills, how to survive and what to eat that occurs naturally in nature, because we don't know that the supermarket's going to be here in 2 years.
We need a new Buell Gibbons.
And I've also thought, in terms of, you know, Obama's pushing infrastructure, I think that's a great way to put people to work, and we know that things need to be repaired. But we need to stop and think about, are we just going to continue to run cars and trucks up and down the highway indefinitely when we don't yet have a fleet that's clean? And what are the alternatives to that? And we're really not having that conversation that I'm aware of in any significant way.
Well, we started, and there was a significant piece of the Stimulus Act, which was loans.
Green energy.
Yeah, green energy. And of course, the Republicans and Fox News are doing everything they can to take that out and trying to turn, you know, Solyndra into the scandal du jour.
I mean, these people are still having fits about light bulbs, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
You know, they're operating in about 1910 America is where their heads are.
Yeah.
The rest of us need to leap ahead about 50 years and imagine a future that is post-fossil fuel.
and post-centralized energy.
And
you know, where communities produce their own energy and everything is recycled. You know, one of the most...
their own food and their own...
Yes, I'm totally with you, Virginia. Thank you very much for the call. Here's just a simple concept to wrap your head around that I think most people have never thought of, that I find profound. Everything in nature produces waste, right? Everything poops, everything exhales, everything complex organisms do, but even single-celled organisms produce waste. Everything produces waste. That waste, 100% of the time, is food for something else. There is no thing in nature that produces waste that isn't food for something else, except humans. And up until about 1850, well, I mean, you know, at that point, it was probably some minimal amount, you know, the production of, you know, the ash from burning coal and things. But up until the Industrial Revolution, we didn't produce waste that other things didn't use. I mean, even our bodies got recycled in wooden caskets. But now we produce stuff that nothing can eat. We produce plastic that'll be around in 1,000 years. We produce atomic waste that'll be around in 1,000,000 years. We need to start asking ourselves, can this waste be recycled? And the answer has to be yes, 100% of the time. We need to make some really significant policy changes. Alex in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Hi, Tom. A long time ago, I found out about a meeting that the government had in 2008. The Bush administration, they got briefed about a problem with the sun. Apparently, I mean, there's actually an article on the National Geographic magazine. Apparently, next year we're going to have a repeat of a huge solar storm that, according to the government report, I suppose there's a huge chance that they're going to damage the power grid and leave huge regions of the United States in the East Coast and the West Coast without electricity for prolonged periods of time. They're actually predicting periods between 2 to 4 years. Mm-hmm. And they're also predicting, in the original report, they're predicting deaths in the numbers of 50 million people because of the lack of communication and electricity. People are going to die because of no food, no trucks coming with food. And so far, as far as I know...
We had something like this happen, Alex, in the 1980s. There was a solar storm. It blacked out the Northeast. People thought it was flying saucers. Nobody could figure out what it was, and it was a solar storm. And it just threw so much energy into the electrical grid, the grid couldn't handle it. And this is one of the reasons why we need to start doing what Europe has been doing, and that is moving to smart grids for a centralized system. And we need to do what a lot of developing countries are doing, and that is develop local economies that are, that are based on solar power or biomass or other natural wind power, or whatever, that don't have grids and therefore are not vulnerable to things like these solar storms. Because you're right, we're at solar minimum, or we were at solar minimum a couple of years ago, and we're heading towards solar maximum again. And it may well present a problem, but again, it's not the end of the world coming. Yet, but there's a lot we can do. Chip in Unionville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Chip, we got a minute of the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I just want to get touch on you with the fact that I think what they're waiting for is for a shock to happen as well.
That's what we're always waiting for, Chip.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think they're waiting for with the environment. And I don't know what they're going to do when that happens.
Yeah.
I don't think that they can save us.
Well, it depends on how you define save, and it depends on, which us you're talking about. I can tell you there's a lot of very wealthy people who have compounds that are completely off the grid, and they're growing their own food, and they've got giant solar panels and windmills and whatnot,
I'm trying to do that myself, too, but come on.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you. This is why we need to be having these conversations nationally.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
Naomi Klein's book, I'm like... my God.
Yeah. And what do we do when the phytoplankton is gone? I mean, without being too depressing about it, we are seeing changes on this planet that if we don't adapt to really quickly, we will become like the dinosaurs. And I believe we have the possibility and the tools to adapt to them and to stop them or at least slow them down.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The only problem is the Koch brothers, the Republican Party, the oil and coal barons, ExxonMobil don't want us to use those tools. Welcome back. Armando Robles is with us. He is the president of the United Electrical Workers, Local 1110, euunion.org is the website. Armando, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. You guys are putting together a worker cooperative out of a shutdown factory. Do I have this right?
Yeah, correct. A group of former workers of Republic Windows and Doors, Occupy, and Sirius Energy, former workers, we came with this new idea to make a new era Windows cooperative here in Chicago after the two occupations we passed by the last 4 years ago.
So how's it going?
We are talking with the company, Sirius Energy, who's closed the factory on last February.
Mm-hmm.
They give us a Warn Act notice, and they planning close the factory. But we demand the factory to keep the companies 90 days with the main purpose of to sell the company. After the 90 days, when we see nobody being interested to buy the company, so we decide to form a cooperative.
What can our listeners and viewers do to help you in your efforts, or should they learn from your efforts and try something like this on their own?
I learned this on 2009 after our first occupation from Republic.
Mm-hmm.
We've been on the Victory Tour in 2009, and I met Naomi Klein and Abby Lewis and two guys from Argentina and a guy from Workers' Word. His name is Brandon Marty.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the one asked me why we don't form a cooperative, but the team in that time, Sirius Materials, was purchasing the machinery from Republic Windows and Doors.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a contract with UE and Sirius Materials to recruit all the workers having same salary, same benefits. But after 3 years, they close again, so we decide to take the wheel on our hands and start with this project.
This is absolutely spectacular. Armando Robles, the president of the United Electrical Workers Local 1110, who is taking Republic Windows and Doors, which they've occupied and kept here in America for a couple of years now, and turning it into a worker-owned co-op, which I think is the next big thing that's going to replace capitalism. Armando, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And people can check that out again at UE, as in United Electrical, ueunion.org. That is so wonderful. It's just so great what they're doing. Sean in Pittston, Pennsylvania. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say about global warming. You know, 200 years ago, we were burning scientists at the stake or, you know, shunning them away for believing that the world was round and the Earth revolved around the sun.
Yep.
And then you got global warming. Republicans are not believing it. Believe me, the Republicans existed back then. But my question to you is, you mentioned about when there was that blackout in the Northeast, it was that solar storm.
Yeah.
Is there a way that we could harness that because it overloaded the system with so much power?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. If there is, and there probably is, nobody is taking, to the best of my knowledge, any steps to do that. So,
be nice.
Yeah, I mean, hey, you know, we should be harnessing. I mean, right now, every hour, the sun dumps onto this planet more power than the entire Earth uses in a year. All of humans on Earth use in a year. And if we could harness that with even, you know, 1% efficiency over 1% of the Earth's land mass, we could, you know, we could dump, you know, carbon fuels, carbon-based fuels. I mean, there's so much we could do that we should be doing. So, anyhow, thanks a lot for the call. Well said, Sean. I appreciate it. Brian in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, you know, speaking of tornadoes, I wish I had the count, but aren't they off the chart? I mean,
yeah.
And they start earlier, and they're coming at night. You know, when I was a kid, and I'm in Omaha, I'm in the Midwest, we had a lot of tornadoes. I don't remember them coming in the evening. I could, you know, it could just be me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I grew up in Michigan, and we had tornadoes every summer. I mean, it was, you know, it was tornado season in southern Michigan. And
fires in Denver. Now, this reminds me of California the last two or three years, and something they didn't mention. You know, we all know that fires are common and that, you know, it's part of the renourishing of the environment and that kind of thing. But the fires that they don't report, and here's another thing I'll get to in a point, is how hot that fire was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's burned up. California's burned up. And I have had seen no information on how bad it is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the main thing is we got junk journalism.
Yep.
It's
called infotainment. I was at a conference last week where the vice president of one of the big three networks spoke. And he said, we get it, I'm paraphrasing now, I wish I'd written down his exact words, but there were words to the effect of, we get it, we are in the infotainment business, our job is to get eyeballs and ears.
Absolutely.
And deliver them to advertisers.
They said that CBS put the newsroom into the entertainment business, I think, in the 60s?
No, it was 87, 88.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right after Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine in 87.
Somebody had, you know, a point to the other point where there was always another side of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. It used to be that the news was actually fair and balanced. You know, the phony baloney slogan that Fox called news is. And now nothing is, you know, it's all infotainment.
Yeah, I can tell you that it will never get better with the entertainment journalism that we've got. And you're an exception to the whole thing, but you don't have that wide audience CBS and NBC and, you know, the big Viacom networks have.
Yeah. We're getting there step by step. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, coming up tomorrow, I'll have a rumble with conservative Peter Ferrara about his miseducation of Mitt Romney and what you need to know about Mitt's plans for your kids. Plus, Virge Bernero, the mayor of Lansing, Michigan, will be here to talk about his new campaign to buy local, buy American. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.